on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 94-year-old World War II veteran Francisco Paredes of Atwater, California. You'll find him most days right where I interviewed him, at the Victor S. Machado VFW Post 9946 in Atwater. It's named for one of the more than 400,000 Americans who did not come home from World War II. Mr. Paredes lost quite a few friends during the war, and as we're about to hear, he had some pretty close calls himself. You can find some photos and video clips at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And before I brought you back to reflect more on Pearl Harbor, you started to share how not long after that you were headed toward Australia. Can we pick it up right there?
But we didn't make it to Australia on account of we didn't have an escort or anything. So we pulled into Auckland, New Zealand. They treated us like kings, you know. And then all of a sudden, we got news that there was a destroyer escort taking us into Australia. So we finally made it to Australia, to Sydney. And then in Sydney, we were stationed at the King's Row Park. Then we were there for about maybe 3 or 4 days, and we got put on a train heading up to Cairns, Australia. That was when the Battle of the Coral Sea was starting to go on. So then after the Battle of the Coral Sea, we weren't getting no supplies. No, the Air Force asked for volunteers, and I volunteered to be a machine gunner on a B-25. And going towards Port Moresby to make a bombing run, we got one of our wings shot off, so we had to bail out. That was my first parachute jump.
So you're in the Army, but you're still not assigned to any division or outfit, right? And they wanted volunteers to go on B-25s?
They needed a gunner. Everything was going to Europe at the start of the war in the Pacific. So Europe was getting all the supplies. And they needed a volunteer gunner. That was the 5th Air Force. So I volunteered. And as we were making our run over Port Moresby, New Guinea, anti-aircraft or guns, you know, started shooting at us. And they blew part of our wing off. So the pilot says, get ready to bail out. I had never bailed out.
Well, you haven't had any aerial training at all, right?
No, I've never had any aerial training at all.
Doesn't that sound a little ridiculous to you?
Right. But, I mean, I enlisted to do what I had to do. Yeah. So I bailed out. Everybody got safe. The plane crashed naturally, you know, because we abandoned the plane. But we landed in the water, and we were there for a couple of hours. But we had Mae West life jackets, and we had a vial that you squeezed it, and they would send out phosphorus. There was a shark repellent. There were sharks there, that was for sure. But in about 2 hours later, we got picked up by a PT boat, and they sent us back to Cairns. We got checked out and everything. So anyway, then I joined the 32nd Infantry Division, which was a Wisconsin National Guard. I joined the 126th Regiment. So we joined the 9th and 7th Australian divisions. They were freshly come back. They were called the Rats of Tobruk in the Middle East someplace. I don't know where.
Yeah, that's in Libya. And the Rats of Tobruk are still legendary in Australia. About 14,000 Australian troops held off the Desert Fox, Erwin Rommel, from April to August of 1941. Rommel, at that point, had never been defeated, so this was a big deal. And these Australian forces dug a network of tunnels. They used them very effectively. That's thought to be some of the inspiration for that Rats label. And when German propaganda broadcasts described them as caught like rats in a trap, they adopted that rat nickname. They even went so far as to make rat-shaped medals from the metal of a German bomber they shot down with German guns they had captured. The Rats of Tobruk are a great chapter of World War II history before America was ever involved in the war. So these are the Australians that you were fighting alongside. They were already seasoned veterans, and you join up with these Rats of Tobruk in New Guinea in 1942. Where'd you go?
We joined them crossing the Owen Stanley Range. We were on the way to Buna Gona. But we were on the Kokoda Trail, and there was nothing but couldn't carry trucks or anything like that, you know. It was all pulled by horses. So anyway, we weren't getting any supplies or anything, you know. So we ran out of food. We got a lot of malaria, dysentery, dengue fever, fighting all the elements. And we were hungry. So we started eating horse meat till we got to Kokoda. And then we went all the way to Buna Gona. And Buna and Gona were still held by the Japanese. And I think the Navy did a lot of bombarding and this and that, you know. When I got to Buna Gona, they asked for volunteers because I had been, you know, in the ocean, you know. There was a new outfit which was called Special Amphibious Brigades. So I joined the 2nd Amphibious Brigade, and that's when I started making landings, you know, landing troops on D-Day landings. So I was assigned to the 1st Marine Division, and we did a lot of small landings and some big landings, too. And we also supplied the Coast Watchers.
And there's another fascinating aspect of World War II that we really haven't discussed on this program, but you can read more about it if you pull up Mr. Paredes' story on hometownheroesradio.com. The Coast Watchers were a group of about 400 people from Australia, New Zealand, some of the other Pacific Islands, native tribesmen who operated behind enemy lines and helped the Allies in many ways. Maybe the most famous example was the Coast Watchers' involvement in the rescue of future President John F. Kennedy after the explosion of PT-109. Anyway, so supplying those Coast Watchers was a facet of your job with the 2nd Engineer Special Brigade. It sounds like pretty dangerous duty. And what happened next?
So anyway, one of my friends, he got caught by the Japanese, and they beheaded him.
Where was that?
That was in New Guinea.
And I'm sure that had to be really hard for you to deal with, and it probably also tells you what would happen to you if you got caught, right?
That's it. You know, a lot of people don't believe that I ran into people, Japanese people, using babies in the Philippine Islands for bayonet practice. There's two Japanese people who pick up this kid, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years old, even babies, toss them up in the air, and the Japanese guy would come and stab them. And that was hard to do, to watch that, you know. So I remember one time in New Guinea, I got into a hand-to-hand combat with one. It was a boy, but I don't think he was 17 years old. And he wasn't, I don't know, maybe he was suicidal or whatever, but he did get me a little bit. But I said, sorry, but it's you or me, and I got him.
You mentioned making beach landings. What were the beach landings that you were involved in?
The one that I remember the most was in Cape Lasser, New Britain. We went in there with the 1st Marine Division and the 32nd Infantry Division, the 126th Regiment. We landed them, came back, took another load, of Marines and infantry, took them in, and then we wait for people to bring dead and wounded. Then I pick up the dead and the wounded and take them to the hospital ship, which was, you know, laid out, you know, offshore. Take them, unload them, and then go back and get another load. It would be maybe 10, 12 trips.
On what, on a LCVP or?
They were LCMs. My number was 696. I'll never forget that because, you know, it got full of holes, you know, by machine gun fire, you know, but we made it all right.
Well, and you mentioned machine gun holes, and I know that that duty to bring out the dead and wounded had to be very taxing emotionally, but you mentioned machine gun holes, and you told me you were wounded 3 times during the war. Where were those 3 occurrences? Tell me about them.
Once I got wounded in New Guinea, and the one that was going to treat me, he was a medic. The Marines called him corpsman, you know, but yeah, we called him medics. Called the medic, and when he came out to take care of me, he got shot. I got picked up with somebody else, I don't know who. and they took me to a hospital. They sent me back to Australia. I was in the hospital in Australia for a while. They took care of me good, you know, and then they sent me back to my unit.
Tell me how you got hit. What was happening at the time? How did it all unfold?
It was a bonsai attack. Japanese, you know, they pulled a bonsai on you whenever they could.
So you're in a defensive position, and all of a sudden a bullet from somewhere hits you? Where?
Oh, I got hit in the leg. In fact, I have a silver kneecap.
And then you call a medic, and then he gets killed trying to help you out. I mean, what goes through your head in a situation like that? It sounds pretty desperate to me.
Yes, but I mean, you know, I says, this wound is going to send me home. No way. They needed us over there.
So that was the first time you were wounded. What was the second?
The second time was in the Philippine Islands. That was in Tacloban, Leyte. We landed in Tacloban, Leyte, and across was an island, Samar. And on my boat, I picked up a dead Japanese dead body in between the propellers. So I had to pull in the beach and tie my boat up, you know, and get under water and change propellers. But first chop the body out. It was tangled in both the propellers. So I chopped them out. In the meantime, while the guy was giving me oxygen in my mask, we get a raid, you know, and he pulled the cord, you know, told me that meant a signal for me to get up, you know. So a bomb hits, I'd say maybe about 100, 150 feet. But the concussion on the water, you know, it hurt my ears. That's not when I got wounded. That's when I got up. When I got out, you know, and I was going to try getting my boat off the beach. So I manned my machine gun. And here comes a zero strafing. And one of the bullets got into the cockpit and went circled, you know, round and round. And it hit me here, went around, hit the well deck. Yeah. I mean, the cockpit, hit another one. And then I got another one back here.
So you got hit on the right rib cage and in the left side of your back, kind of almost simultaneously.
But I mean, that Japanese Zero didn't last very long. Because the Navy was there, you know, and the Air Force were there. In fact, I'm lucky that I got out of there because there was bullets flying all over the damn place.
Well, yeah, and it seems to me if you get hit on your side and in your back, there's a lot of organs in there that could have been damaged by that. You're probably pretty fortunate to have survived that.
Right. So anyway, I did get my third wound.
Well, let's finish up the second one first. How bad was it? How much pain were you in? And
I was in a lot of pain, you know, but I had, you know, some sulfanilamide powder, and I had a bandage, you know, had a first aid kit, and I had morphine, give a shot, you know.
You had to take care of yourself.
I took care of myself, yes. Yeah. Took care of my wounds, and I was fine.
Did you at all consider the possibility that you might not make it out of that?
Yes. I said, maybe this is my time to go, but the big boy up there, you know, he took care of me.
It sure sounds like it. And so that was in the Philippines on Leyte. And then you said a third time you were wounded. Where was that and how'd that happen?
The third time was in the Philippines again. That was in Ormoc, you know. That was across the Tacloban on the other end of the island.
Ormoc, sir, there's a big horseshoe kind of bay there, right?
Yeah, right. So I got wounded there too. The same thing, you know, on the boat, you know, and...
So you're still operating this LCM, and it was aircraft fire again?
Yes. When I got wounded there, I landed on the beach, and I dug in. My LCM, you know, was broached. Couldn't pull it out. So I had to abandon it, went on the beach, and then I dug a hole, you know, in the sand, and then a bomb fell about from here to my van. And I got blown up in the air about maybe 15, 18 feet. And I come back down, and then on the way down, I got hit with a piece of shrapnel right here.
Right under your chin. So the bomb hits 50 feet away, you go sky high, and on your way down, something slices you on the top of your neck, bottom of your chin?
The doctor He says, Sergeant, he says, I can't operate on you because it's too close to your jugular vein. Says, eventually, hopefully, it's going to travel, and it's going to travel away from your jugular vein. So when I got out about, it was about maybe 40 years later, I started getting a toothache.
I think everybody can tell where this is going, but we need to take a break. So hold that thought. Francisco Paredes, 94 years old, quite a story, and we're not done with it yet. We'll pick it up in the dentist chair when we come back. If you want to check out photos of Mr. Paredes and even a video where he shows you the different places he was wounded, hop on to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
I'm really trying to redefine the hearing aid in general. Today's modern hearing aid is vastly different from your father's or grandfather's hearing aid.
Nathan Lev, owner of Sound Advice, with an eye-opener for our ears.
We've got hearing aids now that are directly linked to iPhones. You can stream phone calls directly from your iPhone to your hearing devices without any intermediate piece at all. If you're on a jog and you want to listen to music, you stream music directly from your phone to your hearing device.
Sound Advice, with new innovative products and the best possible care by a licensed hearing aid professional.
Well, I'll be happy to give somebody a consultation. There's no cost to that. I'll give you all the different price points and then shop around, because you have to find not only a device that suits you, but a provider that suits you as well.
Begin your quest for better hearing. Call Sound Advice at 579-1310 or visit online at hearingaidsfresno.com.